In the name of one God, creator, redeemer, and sustainer of our lives, amen. So I want to do a lot of things in this sermon, and so you're going to have to bear with me. I want to talk about fear, because that's what I was struck by in today's text. I want to try out a video system. We're trying out a new video system here, just seeing how that works. So we get to do all of the above. I was struck when I was hearing the David and Goliath story, and we're going to talk a lot about David and Goliath today, about the fear that's there. It's there's this huge man that has everyone basically afraid. I mean, first of all, there's the fear between these two armies that are coming together, and they're about to enter into battle, and neither one of them can quite engage each other. And then there's this fear around this giant and this sense that we're incompetent and inadequate in the face of it. And it's really a story about a young boy who's able to not be afraid, or at least to step into his fear, and rob fear. The story today in Jesus on the waves, and the disciples are in the boat, and there's this huge storm, and they're afraid, right? They're afraid for their lives. The boat is being swamped, and it's being turned and tormented. And again, they feel powerless in the face of their fear. And so they cry out to Jesus, and Jesus is the one that kind of calms and their fear. And it's this sense of being, I think we don't like to talk about fear. I think fear makes us uncomfortable. Fear is one of those things we avoid entering into and dealing with, specifically because we feel powerless in the face of it. There's a connection between powerlessness and fear. And so it's crippling, right? Fear can be crippling. It can rob us of our confidence. It can rob us of any sense of power and agency that we have in this world, which is why it's so insidiously debilitating, I mean, for many people. And why fear is an important thing, I think, to ultimately talk about. And why fear is ultimately a thing that's a very important thing to kind of look at within ourselves and confront. And we've got the occasion of these two texts that help us do it. Today, I remember being on a backpacking trip once with a bunch of friends, and there was a man on the trip I didn't know very well, but he was a friend of a friend, and he was in the middle of going through a recovery program, an AA recovery program, and he was working on his fourth step, which is making an inventory of your life and an inventory of the ways that you have harmed others. But part of this fourth step is making an inventory of the things you're afraid of. You know, and so this guy was working on his fourth step the whole backpacking trip, and we don't know what a fourth step was, and so we were kind of curious about that, and he kind of talked about it as a moral inventory. So we're sitting around a campfire, and we're saying, well, why don't you read us your moral inventory, you know, and read us about all the things that the things that you're ashamed of. And he's like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that, to his credit. And but then he said, I will read you my fear inventory. And he proceeded then to read a list of the things he was afraid of. It's one of the things I've ever heard, to hear another man in his authenticity and integrity just talk about what he was afraid of. And I think it was empowering for me in that moment because I realized I had fears. I had all kinds of fears that I had never looked at, that I had never examined. And here this man was willing to get up. And it was his courage, actually, in the face of fear, that I think was very, was what inspired me profoundly. And that's where I realized courage isn't fearlessness. I mean, a lot of people think that courage is a fearlessness. It's the sense of, you know, these tough guys who get up there and jump out of planes and, you know, do amazing things. And they seem fearless and are able to do things the rest of us don't feel we can do because we're afraid. We feel powerless because we're afraid, and these other guys do these things. But that's not courage. That's just not being afraid. Courage is actually being afraid to do something and doing it anyway. Courage is what it takes to step up to fear and step into fear and to act and to not let that sense of powerlessness overcome you. And that's what I saw in this man. He was afraid, and he read his list to the rest of us gathered around this campfire, and it was a courageous moment, and it was a holy moment. There's something that was sacred about that moment that deeply impacted me. So I want to show a video. It's about David and Goliath. Doesn't talk so much about fear, but we'll see what it does. I want to show the video basically because we need to test this system out. So truth be told, that's what we're going to do. We're going to watch this video. It's a TED Talk. It's Malcolm Gladwell. He's talking about David the day. You know, it's kind of interesting. So that's what we'll do. How about that? If somebody could get the lights, that'd be great.
It's a death wish, right? There's no way they think they can take it. only person who will come forward is this young shepherd woman. He goes up to Saul. He says, I'll fight. And Saul says, you can't fight. It's ridiculous. You're this kid. This is this mighty warrior. But the shepherd is adamant. He says, no, you don't understand. I have been defending my flock against lions and wolves. And Saul has no choice. No one else is coming forward. He says, all right. Then he turns to the kid and says, but you've got to wear this armor. You can't go as you are. So he tries to give the shepherd his armor, and the shepherd says, no. He says, I can't wear this stuff. I the biblical verses, I cannot wear this, for I have not proved it. Meaning I've never worn armor before. He's got to be crazy. So he reaches down instead on the ground, picks up 5 stones, and puts them in his shepherd's bag, and starts to walk down the mountainside to meet the giant. And the giant, this figure approaching him, calls out, come to me so I can feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, right? It issues this kind of taunt towards this person coming to fight him. And the shepherd draws closer and closer, and the giant sees that he's carrying a staff. That's all he's carrying, a simple weapon, just his shepherd's staff. Am I insulted? Am I a dog that you would come to me with sticks? And the shepherd boy takes one of his stones out of his pocket, puts it in his sling, and rolls around, and lets it fly, and hits the giant right between the eyes, right here, in his most vulnerable spot, and falls down, either dead or unconscious, and the shepherd boy runs up and takes his sword and cuts off his head, and the Philistines see this, and they turn on and they just run. And of course, the name of the giant is Goliath, and the name of the shepherd boy is David, and the reason that story has obsessed me over the course of writing my book is that everything I thought I knew about that story turned out to be wrong. So David in that story is supposed to be the underdog, right? In fact, that term, David and Goliath, has entered our language as a metaphor for improbable victories. You over someone far stronger. Now, why do we call David an underdog? Well, we call him an underdog because he's a kid, little kid, and Goliath is this big, strong giant. We also call him an underdog because Goliath is an experienced warrior, and David is just a shepherd. But most importantly, we call him an underdog because all he has is this giant that Goliath is outfitted with all of this modern weaponry, this glittering armor and a sword and a javelin and a spear, and all David has is this sling. Well, let's start there with the phrase, all David has is this sling, because that's the first mistake that we make. In ancient warfare, there are 3 kinds of warriors. There's cavalry, men on horseback and in with chariots. There is heavy infantry, which are foot soldiers, armed foot soldiers with swords and shields and some kind of armor. And artillery are archers, but more importantly, slingers. And a slinger is someone who has a leather pouch with 2 long cords attached to it. And they put a projectile, either a rock or a lead ball, inside the pouch. And they whirl around like this. And they let one of the cords go. And the effect is to send the projectile forward towards the target. That's what David has. It's important to understand that it's not a sling. It's not a slingshot. It's not this, right? It's not a child's toy. It's, in fact, an incredibly devastating weapon. When David rolls it around like this, he's turning the sling around probably at 6 or 7 revolutions per second. And that means that when the rock is released, it's going forward really fast, probably 35 meters per second. That's substantially faster than baseball throw, with the finest of baseball pitchers. More than that, the stones in the Valley of Elah were not normal rocks. They were barium sulfate, which are rocks twice the density of normal stones. If you do the calculations on the ballistic, on the stopping power of the rock fired from David's sling, it's roughly equal to the stopping power of a 45-millimeter handgun. This is an incredibly devastating weapon. Accuracy, we know from historical records that slingers could hit and may more serious or even kill a target at distances of up to 200 yards. From medieval tapestries, we know that slingers were capable of hitting birds in flight. They're incredibly accurate. When David lines up, he's not 200 yards away from Goliath, he's quite close to Goliath. When he lines up and fires that thing at Goliath, he has every attention and every expectation of being able to hit Goliath in this most vulnerable spot between his eyes. If you go back over the history of ancient warfare, you will find time and time again that slingers were the decisive factor against infantry in one kind of battle, in heavy infantry in one kind of battle, or another. So what's Goliath? He's heavy infantry. And his expectation when he challenges the Israelites to a duel is that he's going to be fighting another heavy infantry. Right? When he says, come to me that I might feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the key phrase is come to me. Come up to me because we're going to fight hand to hand like this. Saul has the same expectation. David says, I want to fight Goliath, and Saul tries to give him his armor because Saul is thinking, oh, when you say fight Goliath, you mean fight him in hand-to-hand combat, infantry on infantry. But David has absolutely no expectation. No, he's not going to fight him that way. Why would he? He's a shepherd. He spent his entire career using a sling to defend his flock against lions and wolves. That's where his strength lies. So here he is, this shepherd, experienced in the use of a devastating weapon, up against this lumbering giant, weighed down by 100 pounds of armor, and these incredibly heavy weapons that are useful only in short-range combat. Goliath is a chance. So why do we keep calling David an underdog, and why do we keep referring to his victory as incompetent? The second piece of this that's important, it's not just that we misunderstand David and his choice of weapon. It's also that we profoundly misunderstand Goliath. Goliath is not what he seems to be. There's all kinds of hints of this in the biblical text. Things that are, in retrospect, are quite puzzling and don't square with his image as this mighty warrior. So to begin with, the Bible says that Goliath is led onto the valley floor by an attendant. Now that is weird, right? Here is this mighty warrior going, challenging the Israelites to one-on-one combat. Why is he being led by the hand, by some, you know, young boy, presumably, to the point of combat? Secondly, the Bible story makes special note of how slowly Goliath moves. Another odd thing to say when you're describing the mightiest warrior known to man at that point, right? And then there's this whole weird thing about how long it takes Goliath to react to the sight of David. So David's coming down the mountain, and he's clearly not preparing for hand-to-hand combat, right? There is nothing about him. He's not even carrying a sword. Why does Goliath not react to that? It's as if he's oblivious to what's going on that day. And then there's that strange comment he makes to David. Am I a dog that you should come to me with sticks? Sticks? David only has one stick. Well, it turns out that there's been a great deal of speculation within the medical community over the years about what's fundamentally wrong with Goliath. An attempt to make sense of all of those apparent anomalies. But many articles written, the first one was in 1960 in the India Medical Journal, and it started a chain of speculation that starts with an explanation for Goliath's height. So Goliath is head and shoulders above all of his peers in that group. And usually when someone is that far out of the norm, there's an explanation for it. So the most common form of is a condition called acromegaly. And acromegaly is caused by a benign tumor on your pituitary gland that causes an overproduction of human growth hormone. And throughout history, many of the most famous giants have all had acromegaly. So the tallest person of all time is a man named Robert Broadway, who was still growing when he died at the age of 24, and he was 8'11". He had acromegaly. Remember the rest? He had acromegaly. There's even speculation that Abraham Lincoln had acromegaly. anyone who's ever usually taught us the first explanation we come up with. And acromegaly has a very distinct set of side effects associated with it, principally having to do with vision. The pituitary tumor, as it grows, often starts to compress the visual nerves in your brain, with the result that people with acromegaly have either vision, or they are profoundly nearsighted. So when people started to speculate about what might have been wrong with Goliath, they said, wait a minute, he looks and sounds an awful lot like someone who has acromegaly. And that would also explain so much of what was strange about his behavior that day. Why does he move so slowly and have to be escorted down into the valley floor by an attendant? Because he can't make his way. Why is he so strangely oblivious to David that he doesn't understand that David's not going to fight him until the very last moment? Because he can't see him. When he says, come to me that I might feed your flesh to the birds of the heavens and the beasts of the field, the phrase come to me is a hint also of his vulnerability. Come to me because I can't see you. And then there's, am I a dog that you should come to me with? So the Israelites up on the mountain ridge looking down at him thought he was this extraordinarily powerful foe. What they didn't understand was that the very thing that was the source of his apparent strength was also the source of his greatest weakness. And there is, I think, in that a very important lesson for all of us. Giants are not as strong as they seem. And sometimes the shepherd boy has a sling.
So it's probably a longer video than I normally would want to show, but I thought it was interesting and educational and helped me rethink the whole story of David and Goliath and realize that, I mean, if what he was saying is that, okay, here this people are intimidated by Goliath's size. I mean, he's huge in comparison, right? But yet he had all kinds of deficits. I mean, he couldn't see clearly. Like, he wasn't necessarily, he had height and maybe strength, but he didn't necessarily have agility. But people were so intimidated by their fear of him that they couldn't see clearly. They couldn't see the inherent weaknesses that were there. And David let the fear get to him so he could see clearly. And he knew, and it allowed him to own his own strength. I mean, what Malcolm there does with the different types of warfare, that he knew his own strength and his own power, and it was a different category. It was a different type. It was qualitatively, you know, he was using a projectile rather, he was a slinger rather than artillery. But the point is that fear didn't render him powerless. David's fear, he didn't separate him from his own agency, from his own competence, right? Which is what the nature of fear does. And so, and it allowed David to see clearly. So, I don't know if I have any too much more to say other than that I think fear is a topic because fear is so pervasive in our lives. And fear, those who do want to intimidate us, to bully us, to oppress us, will use fear as a way of doing that. We're not created for fear. We're created for life. We're created to be able to love and enter deeply into relationship with each other. And to the extent that fear cripples us and inhibits us, it's compromising of our life. And you know, Paul writes, it is for freedom us free. And I think part of what I got out of today's, I mean, the gospel where the disciples are in the boat and they're afraid, and Jesus calms the storm. It's a metaphor for for fear in our life and the things that overwhelm us, and the power of God to set us free. Amen.